friends, welcome back to the podcast. If you happen to live in Massachusetts in the 1980s, then you've definitely heard of Daniel LaPlante. But I didn't grow up in Massachusetts in the 1980s, so I only heard about this case about a year ago, and I found it very, very disturbing. You'll have to bear with me as I go through this, because it seems like it's surreal, like something from a bad 90s teen horror film, but these things really happened, and not just the murder of three innocent people, but all of the nightmarish events that took place preceding that. And that's why I want to say right now, a lot of versions of this case misrepresent the facts. I've actually listened to a massive podcaster and a massive YouTuber both get even like the basic details wrong, like people's names in the case. So this whole case has kind of taken on kind of a life of its own. It's become almost like an urban legend. And so obviously rumors and things kind of get tacked on and things get exaggerated. I found an account written by retired Lieutenant Thomas Lane, who was one of the cops involved in this whole crazy series of events. So I'm going to use what he wrote, and I'm going to try to stick to the facts as much as possible. Now, the person at the center of our case today is actually a teenager, and by all means, you can feel sorry for him. I know I did, but only up until a point. Because the things that Daniel LaPlante goes on to do to others, and the terror that he inflicts on purpose, it's so horrifying that it's actually hard to believe. And just so you know, I'm going to give you a trigger warning. There are unfortunately child victims in this case. So let's begin. Daniel LaPlante was born on the 15th of May in 1970 in Townsend, Massachusetts. Townsend became an incorporated town in 1732. There's a pretty small population in the town, and according to last year's census, less than 9,000 people live there, with 90% of those people being white. Daniel's early life and childhood was not a happy tale. Daniel lived on 22 Elm Street with his mother Elaine and his stepfather David and multiple siblings. Daniel suffered sexual and psychological abuse at the hands of his father and stepfather, who would punish him, torment him physically, emotionally, and sexually on a regular basis, which is literally the trifecta of abuse. So it's no wonder that things are going to end up going very badly for this kid. The house they lived in was chaotic, and the surrounding grounds was just a big mess of junk and old cars. Because of his traumatic childhood and the fact that he was diagnosed with dyslexia from a young age, Daniel struggled a lot in school, both academically and socially. Daniel didn't make many friends in school. He was a loner, and by the time he made it to North Middlesex High School, people in his class were referring to him as creepy and weird. It didn't help matters that Daniel didn't have good hygiene at all, like worse than your normal teenage boy. He would come to school smelling very badly. His clothes would be dirty, his hair would be greasy, and he had terrible, terrible acne on his face. I don't know if he didn't like washing. Apparently he had a kind of an aversion to it. Maybe that was because of his terrible home life. But either way, people would make fun of him for it, and they would avoid him at school because he stank and he acted really odd. But I just want to point out here, just because he wasn't that great at school didn't mean he wasn't clever. Daniel was very, very clever and cunning. Now, the school was obviously aware to some extent of the issues that Daniel was dealing with, because at some stage school officials referred him to see a psychiatrist to help him address his abnormal behavior, help him with his dyslexia, and improve his general reluctance towards his own hygiene. So we're thinking, great, Daniel is going to go see a psychiatrist now. Hopefully they can help him with his issues, the ones that he has at school and the ones that he has at home. But no, of course not. These psychiatry sessions would be the furthest thing from positive for Daniel. Firstly, he was diagnosed with hyperactivity disorder, which only made him feel worse about himself. And then, over the next year, his psychiatrist also began sexually abusing him during the sessions. So again, this is another adult in his life with power and authority over him who was sexually abusing him, just adding another layer of shame and misery to his life. By the age of 14, Daniel was beginning to act out, committing petty thefts because he always felt bad about himself and he didn't have a lot in life. In the evenings, probably after school, Daniel would break into people's houses around Townsend to steal some valuables. This would be the beginning of his criminal activity. By the time he was 15, he had gotten pretty talented at burglary, but the stealing wasn't actually his main purpose behind breaking into people's homes anymore. Now, he liked going into the house and tormenting people. He liked moving things around, disturbing things on purpose, so that the people in the house would know that someone had been there. He would do petty little things, like leave things out on the counter, open food and leave it out to be found. He would move people's furniture around just to freak them out. He really liked the thought of making people feel scared and paranoid in their own homes. So eventually, he was breaking into people's houses just to play mind games with them. It wasn't even about valuables or money or taking things anymore. By 1986, Daniel is aged 16 now. He had moved on from just tormenting the homeowners in Townsend, and he was now terrorizing the surrounding neighborhoods. It's at this point that he begins tormenting the Bowen family. The Bowens lived at 93 Lawrence Street in Pepperell, Massachusetts, which was only about 12 minutes away from Townsend. Pepperell was a small, safe, quiet town with not much to do. You see, Daniel had started to become obsessed with Tina Bowen, who was 15 years old. He had seen her at an 8th grade school event. Tina lived with her sister Karen, who was 9 years old, and their father Frank. Only a few months before, her mother had passed away after a battle with cancer, and they were all coping with the terrible loss. Tina was also dealing with a lot of new responsibilities, like taking care of her younger sister, cooking, cleaning, making sure they made it to school. In order to help Tina, her father Frank basically allowed her best friend named Kathy Knapp to move in with them for a while. Kathy had originally lived in Tennessee, but she wanted to stay in Pepperell for high school, so Frank offered to be her guardian, and the arrangement worked out. The girls felt like they had another sister, and for a while, things were great. One day, the Bowen family's washing machine broke down, so the girls brought the dirty laundry to the local laundromat. While they waited for the clothes to wash, they began dancing to some music. There was a big glass window in the laundromat, and so some boys were walking past, and they saw the girls dancing, and, you know, they were being cute and flirting, and they wanted to exchange numbers. Tina was thrilled with the attention, and she gave the boys her phone number. After a while, Tina started to get phone calls from a boy named Daniel. He claimed to have gotten her phone number from a mutual friend. He had actually gotten it from one of the boys at the Townsend laundromat. The phone calls went on for months between the two of them, and Tina was like very flattered to be chatting with this boy who was so interested in her. He described himself to her, saying he was handsome, that he was athletic, that he was blonde and popular, and he was a jock. So they became closer friends, and Tina opened up to him about losing her mother. And after a while, Daniel asked Tina to go on a date with him, so she agreed. But when Tina opened the front door and she found the real Daniel LaPlante waiting on her doorstep, she was shocked. He was the opposite of who she thought she was talking to. This guy had greasy dark hair, he had terrible acne, he had bad hygiene, his clothes were all dishevelled, he didn't look like he took care of himself at all. But despite not thinking Daniel was attractive, Tina didn't want to hurt his feelings or make an awkward scene, so she went with him on the date to the movies anyway. Then on the following Sunday around Easter, Daniel went out with Tina and Karen for Easter dinner. But it became more and more uncomfortable for Tina because Daniel wouldn't stop asking her inappropriate questions about her mother's death, like how she felt when her mother died and how much her mother had suffered when she had died. Tina was getting a really strange feeling in her gut. Something just wasn't right about this guy. So she did the smart thing and she ended the date early, rushing to get home. She also stopped answering and returning Daniel's calls, wanting nothing more to do with this horrible boy. What she didn't know was that Daniel had followed her home to see where she lived. Now, Daniel was obviously upset that Tina had rejected him. But rather than deal with his feelings in any kind of reasonable way, he decided he wanted to get revenge. So he found an entry into the house through the crawl space, which was only about 6 inches wide. After this, life for the Bowens started to get very, very strange. So as we know, the Bowens were down to one parent and one income. So Frank had to go to work for long hours to make enough money to keep the family going. He was working as a hotel manager pretty far from their home, so he wasn't always around. And one night while he was at work, Tina and Kathy were home alone and they decided to try and contact Tina's mom by using a Ouija board. The two girls tried for hours, hoping to hear something from Tina's mother, who she missed very, very badly, but nothing happened. They went to bed feeling pretty defeated. But after a few hours into the night, the girls were woken up by weird tapping sounds coming from the walls of their bedroom. They huddled together and listened for the strange sounds, and sometimes they would even get a bit louder. Now, Tina and Kathy naively did the seance with the hope of success, but they didn't really expect anything to happen. Then, when they started hearing these noises, they became convinced that they were being contacted by the spirit of Tina's mother. Then one day, Tina woke up and she found everything from the garden shed had been pulled out and laid out on the backyard. The shovels, the lawn chairs, the rakes, the bikes. Tina and Kathy looked at each other like, what the hell is going on? They knew that neither of them had done it. They knew that little Karen hadn't done it. So when Frank came home, the two girls told him what happened and he just brushed them off, believing that his grieving daughter was getting carried away with her imagination. He said, it's just your friends playing pranks or maybe the neighbour kids. Just go clean it up. Then one day, in broad daylight, the doorbell rang and Tina went to answer it. She opened the front door, but no one was there. Then 3 days later, in the evening, there was a big thunder and lightning storm. A bolt of lightning illuminated the bay windows in the house, and Tina heard Karen and Kathy screaming their heads off because they said it had lit up the shadow of a human figure in the living room. Night after night, the girls would wake up to the tapping sounds. Sometimes it was like rocks were being thrown at the window. They would shout for their dad, but by the time Frank got there, it would be dead quiet again. One night at 2 a.m., Frank was at work, and the girls hear the noises, and they're so scared that they call the police out to investigate. They found nothing, and then they asked the girls where the parents were, where the adults were, because kids obviously shouldn't be left alone at night like this. So Frank had to come home, and he warned the girls to stop calling the cops, and if they kept this stuff up, he'd have to take them to speak to a grief counselor or something. 3 weeks went by after that. The girls began moving around the house as a team, with Kathy in the front, Karen in the middle, and Tina at the back. That's how scared they were. They thought if they moved around in a kind of a group like this, if somebody jumped out at them or if something happened, more than one of them would see it. On and on, the weird noises kept happening. Then things around the house were being physically tampered with too. Items would mysteriously move. The milk would all be gone. If they were watching TV and they left the room for a few minutes, they would come back and the channel would have been changed. Food would go missing from the fridge. Furniture would get moved around. Say if they put something on the table, they'd come back and find it on the floor. Eventually, the two older girls were convinced that they were being haunted by an evil ghost or something. This thing was causing havoc, and they no longer believed that they were being contacted by the spirit of Tina's mother. Frank was mentally exhausted. He didn't know why his daughters were pulling these stunts. He still believed that they were causing all of this, and he told the two girls to stop doing this, put a stop to it once and for all. Now, even though the girls told him that they weren't responsible for bringing this evil spirit into the house, he refused to entertain this story, and he just believed that they were struggling emotionally or looking for attention. So weeks went on like this, and one evening the knocking noises started again. This time Tina and Kathy were angry. Kathy grabbed a plastic baseball bat. On this particular evening, however, the sounds were coming from the basement of the house, not the walls. So the two girls, who were much braver than I would have been, they grabbed the bat and they cautiously crept down the stairs into the basement to try and find what or who was making the noise. They shouted, "Come out once and for all, whoever you are." They went down into the basement and they were greeted by a terrifying sight. On the basement wall, written in red liquid, were the words, "I'm in your room, come and find me." The girls ran upstairs and they fled from the house screaming until they got to the neighbors. There they waited until Frank came home. They told Frank what they had found in the basement, but when Frank went downstairs and realized that this message wasn't written in blood like the two girls had thought, it was actually written in ketchup, and he got really annoyed and he thought they had been the ones to deface his walls. Then on a Friday night, Tina was supposed to meet Kathy at the roller skating rink after she was done babysitting. So at the time, it was only Tina and her dad at the house. Tina was in the bathroom getting ready when a really loud crack hit the bathroom window, actually cracking the glass pane. She ran to get her dad, and Frank went outside. He found a BB gun and a bag of candy outside. Someone had clearly just left them behind. Then Tina picked up the phone to call Kathy, but the phone line was dead. So then she picked up the other phone in the house, and she still got nothing. The phone lines had been cut, and the ends were burned. Now this was the first time that Frank actually sees there's something more than just silly pranks going on here. So Frank reports this to the police, and the phone lines are eventually repaired. For a while, all the weird activity stops. Then Karen gets sick one day, so Tina stays home to babysit her and watch her. Kathy isn't with them at the time. The two girls are sitting in bed watching TV, and then all of a sudden the radio in the kitchen starts blaring music, and the cupboards start banging. Tina is terrified. She calls her dad to say someone is in the house. He tells her, "Tina, no one is in the house. We're going to have a talk when I get home." Meanwhile, Karen goes into the kitchen because she's hungry and she wanted a snack. She was annoyed. All the cupcakes and orange juice they had just bought the day before were gone. Tina made up a lie to calm down her little sister. And she said, "Don't worry, Kathy must have taken them to school. A little while later, though, Karen started shouting, "I found them! I found them! The cupcakes, they're right here!" Tina went to see what her sister had found. There was a box of cupcakes with only a few wrappers left. It had just suddenly appeared on the counter, where it wasn't a few moments before. The girls were freaked out, and they left the house. When the family got home that night, with Frank, they come into the house, and they find that all the lights are turned on, all the TVs are turned on, and all the radios are turned on to full volume. Tina tells her dad, "See, I'm not lying. There's something not right going on here." So Frank and Karen go through the house and they turn off all the radios and TVs. Everything seemed fine. Frank enrolled the girls into therapy, and for a while after this, things were pretty normal again. For a few days, there was no tapping noises, and things around the house actually stayed in their place. That was until December 8th. Frank was at work, and Tina and Kathy and Karen were at home. They found someone had used their bathroom and left their mess behind. The noise had started again, and this time the girls heard them coming from Tina's bedroom. When they went into her room, on Tina's wall was written, "I'm back. Find me if you can." Once again, the girls ran freaking out of the house, screaming. They went to the neighbors and they called Frank and they told him that he had to come home, that they were too scared to go back into the house without him. Frank came home and he flipped out. He decided that he was going to literally search the house from top to bottom to prove to the kids that there was no ghost or no monster in the house. So he pulled open the front door, but to his surprise, the house was ransacked inside. Furniture was upside down. Things were a mess. And when he looked at the ceiling, there were hundreds of pennies glued onto the ceiling. And on the wall, in red, was another message. This one said, "Marry me." I think at this moment, Frank was finally beginning to realize that something sinister was going on, and maybe his daughters weren't lying, and they weren't just doing this to mess with him. So he slowly made his way upstairs. He pulled open the closet door, and inside he found a man with spiked dark hair. His face was smeared and painted with makeup like war paint. He was wearing a fur jacket, not the wedding dress of the girl's deceased mom, like a lot of stories around this case will report. And in this man's hand was a hatchet. Frank told the girls to get behind him. He put up his hands in the air and he said, "It's okay. This is just a homeless person looking for food. It's okay. It's okay." The intruder backed the Bowens into one of the bedrooms in a very calm manner. Frank locked the bedroom door and he tried to keep the girls calm. Karen was crying. She was terrified and she was confused. Tina immediately went over to the phone in the bedroom, but the cord had physically been pulled from the wall and so had the light fixture. Tina started to hyperventilate, saying over and over again, "No light, no phone, no light, no phone, no light, no phone." But instead of giving in to the panic that was overwhelming her, she looked out the bedroom window and she saw the light on at the neighbor's house. So Tina jumped out of the second story bedroom window, knowing that at any second, this maniac with a hatchet could break down the bedroom door and hurt her family. Kathy stuck her head out of the window and she screamed, "Run, Tina, run!" Tina ran into the dark, all the way to the neighbor's house. She thought at any second this creep was going to come and get her. She finally got to the neighbor's house and banged on the door, shoving past them when they finally opened it, and screamed that there was a guy in the house with an axe and that he was going to kill her whole family. The neighbor called the police to tell them that there was an intruder holding the Bowens hostage, but now all Tina could do was wait. When the officers arrived, they found Frank Bowen, his his daughter and their friend had not been harmed. Frank said he didn't know where the intruder went. He had either fled or, even more worryingly, he could still be somewhere in the house. Frank estimated that the intruder was a man of about 22 years of age. Tina told the police that she thought the intruder could have been maybe anywhere from 17 to 26 years old, and that he was about 6 foot tall. When the family reunited with Tina, Frank held her in his arms and he gave her a huge apology. The fear and stress had prevented anyone, even Tina, from recognizing that the intruder was Daniel LaPlante, who was actually about 5'8" and 140 pounds. The police did a search of the Bowens house using their canine unit, and their search came up with nothing. They looked under beds, they looked in the woodland area around the house, nothing turned up. Lieutenant Lane found the intruder's hatchet on the ground outside, though. The family was advised not to spend the night in their house. So now the Bowens are terrified out of their minds. They now knew that there had been someone in their house messing with them for weeks and that this guy hadn't been found yet. Where could he have possibly gone? So the Bowens didn't go back to their house. They evacuated from the place and they went to stay with some relatives. But 2 days later, on December 10th, Frank returned to the house to grab a few essentials. As he walked up to the house, he looked through the window and saw a figure standing inside the second floor bedroom. He was waving out of the window at him. Pepperell Police received another call from the Bowen residence. Officer Stephen Besenson arrived and he met Frank outside. He told the officer that he had seen the same man who had held his family hostage back inside the house. Officer Besenson said, "I could tell as I drove up, he was very upset. I could tell as I drove up, he was pointing at the house. I said to myself, here we go. He's going to say he saw the guy at the window." So Besenson got the house key from Bowen. He checked the snow around the house for any sign of fresh tracks, and then he entered the house. There were no sign of footprints or a break-in. Officer Besenson opened the door and he entered the house. On the right-hand wall, he saw a knife sticking out of the wall like someone had just stabbed it into it. The knife was going through a family picture, and written on the wall in marker was the message, "I'm still here. Come and find me." The hair on the back of Besenson's neck went up. On the other wall, there was another message saying, "I'm going to kill you all." Steve Besenson immediately called for backup. Chief David Young and Sergeant Jim Scott came to the house and all three of the officers searched the house again, still finding nothing. The officers were at a loss and they were starting to get annoyed. Besenson said, "That bastard is still here. We're missing something." He knew that the pictures with the knife stuck in them were not on the wall when the officers had last searched the house and locked it up. So he knew that that meant the creep must still be in there somewhere. So they went down to the basement, where there was a small laundry room, and they noticed there was this kind of false wall in the corner. Frank told them, "Oh, that wall just hides the pipes." But Besenson asked for a flashlight, and he stood up on this 4 foot kind of foundation. And he said, "Wait, there's just enough space behind this wall for someone to fit and hide." Besenson looked down into the triangular space at the bottom. There was a pile about 3 or 4 foot tall of dirty clothes. He pulled out his pistol, realizing that the intruder was hiding completely under this pile of clothes. Besenson said, "I got the son of a bitch right here. Let me see your hands real slow or I'll splatter your brains all over that wall." Besenson said at that moment he realized this guy was dangerous, really, really dangerous. He said that he wasn't afraid of having a police officer stick a gun to his head. This guy just looked out of the corner of his eye. he wasn't scared of being caught. Now, this kind of matched with what Frank Bowen had told the police about the intruder. He said he was very calm and very collected. He was the one telling the family what to do. He was very clever, and he wasn't nervous at all, even though he was outnumbered. So just to explain this hiding place a bit better, the space was kind of like a triangle in a corner. Two of the sides were concrete foundation, and there was an inner wall, and there was a wall which was kind of facing outwards, separating the room from the pipes. And there was just enough space for someone, i.e. Daniel, to crouch. And he would even actually sleep crouched down in there. He was able to hide behind these narrow interior walls and move throughout the house unnoticed, watching the Bowen girls, listening to their conversations and tormenting them. They even found when they searched the house that the electrical sockets in Tina's room had been loosened from the wall, which allowed Daniel to watch her. It was a very minuscule space. It was hard to believe that any human being could climb and squeeze through such narrow openings. Some were literally the width of a standard sheet of paper. When Tina learned that the person, this creep, pulled from the walls of their house was Daniel LaPlante, she immediately blamed herself. He had been doing all of this to them for months, she felt, because of her. Now, Lieutenant Lane was actually at the district attorney's office in Ayr, Massachusetts, at the district court, when he got the call about Daniel LaPlante's arrest. He said that euphoria doesn't even cover how he felt when he heard the news. He headed back to the police station, where Daniel was being booked. Now, normally, at a booking, two photos of the individual are taken. But Lieutenant Lane decided to take 6 photos of Daniel because something in his gut was telling him that these extra photos could prove to be very useful in the future. Lane had a very, very bad feeling about Daniel, sensing there was something very sinister about this young man. So Lieutenant Lane then had to transport Daniel and another juvenile facing charges to the Ayr District Court. This second juvenile offender said that Daniel had told him that he had done certain things at the Bowen house to confuse the Bowen family and actually make them fight amongst themselves. Daniel told them specific things like he would change the channel on the TV, he would drink a glass of milk when no one was in the room, and he even bragged about taking the Bowen family hostage. Daniel was charged with breaking and entering, kidnapping, armed assault in a dwelling, larceny and malicious damage to property. Then, because he was only 17 at the time, he was sent to a juvenile detention facility where he spent the next 10 months. After those 10 months, Judge Joseph Travelline decided to release Daniel LaPlante on a $10,000 bail in mid-October 1987. Daniel's mother, Elaine, had to remortgage her home to get the 10 grand for her son's bail. Clearly, Judge Travelline didn't see Daniel in the same light as law enforcement did. He didn't see the threat that Daniel posed to people around him. And he didn't seem to consider the risk of the defendant fleeing, the type of the crime alleged, or the dangerousness of the defendant and the safety of the community. Because if he had, maybe Daniel could have been stopped from committing his most horrific crime only 2 months later. That's right. Even after all we've discussed, we haven't even covered the worst of it yet. So now Daniel was back out in Townsend, awaiting his trial. He was back at home, and you'd think that maybe his parents might finally try to control him or keep an eye on him so he didn't cause more trouble. But, of course they didn't. And, for his part, Daniel didn't really seem to care about getting into more trouble with the law anyway, because he kept burglarizing people. On October 14th, 1987, Daniel stole 2 .22 caliber firearms from a neighbor's house. A month later, on November 16th, he burglarized the Gustafsson home for the first time. The Gustafssons were a very loving family made up of Priscilla Gustafsson, who was a 33-year-old nursery school teacher, and she was pregnant at the time, her husband Andrew Gustafsson, and their two children, 5-year-old William and 7-year-old Abigail. Daniel would return to the Gustafsson home on the 1st of December by walking through the woods separating his house and the Gustafsson. He was armed with one of the 22 caliber guns at the time, and it was loaded. On that day, Andrew was at work, but Daniel later claimed that he didn't expect Priscilla and William to come home while he was still inside of the house. But we know that this isn't true, because after he broke into the house the first time in November, he decided to go back with a gun, and he lied to one of his brother's friends in order to get bullets from him to use in the gun. Then he also practiced loading and unloading guns in between his two visits to the Gustafsson's house. According to the court transcript for the Commonwealth versus Daniel J. LaPlante, when Daniel heard Priscilla Gustafsson and her 5-year-old son William entering the house, he said that his first thought was to jump out the window, but he decided not to. Instead, he confronted them with the gun and he brought them to the bedroom. He put William in the closet and he tied Priscilla to the bed. Daniel said that after he tied Priscilla to the bed, his plan was to leave, but once again, he decided not to. Instead, he made the decision to rape her. And after raping her, he acknowledged again that he could have left. Instead, Daniel decided that he would kill her. And Daniel LaPlante shot Priscilla Gustafsson 2 times in the head. After he killed Priscilla, Daniel took William into the bathroom and he drowned him in the bathtub. Then, just as he was leaving, 7-year-old Abigail had just gotten off the bus and come home from school. He lured her into the bathroom, and there he made the decision to drown her as well. After drowning Abigail in the other bathroom, he fled the scene. Daniel then went home. He ate and he attended his 6-year-old niece's birthday party, as if he hadn't just calmly and coldly murdered 3 people. When Andrew Gustafsson came home that evening, he thought it was unusual that there were no lights on in the house. It was totally dark. Andrew went upstairs and he went into the bedroom, discovering his wife Priscilla's body tied to the bed. He ran downstairs and he called the police, telling them that his wife had been murdered and he didn't know where his 2 children were. He couldn't bear to go back into the house. He was too afraid in case he found the children in the same state as his wife. Officer George Aho was one of the first 2 officers to arrive on the Gustafsson murder scene. He said when he and the other officer went upstairs, Priscilla was on her back on the bed with a pillow over her face. They could see that she had been shot through the pillow in order to muffle the sound. The officers began searching the house for the children. Officer Aho went into the upstairs bathroom. The shower curtain was pulled closed, and when Officer Aho pulled it back, he found the little blonde-haired boy lying face down in the tub, and there was hardly any water in it at all. He said they then went downstairs to search, finding Abigail in the downstairs tub. There was still water in the tub, and Officer Aho felt that she had fought to stay alive. There was evidence that the crimes had been committed sometime between 1:30 p.m. and 5 p.m. A neighbour said they heard a girl scream from the direction of the Gustafsson home around 3:35 p.m. In that one afternoon, Andrew Gustafsson lost his wife, his 2 children, and his unborn baby. Lieutenant Lane was once again at the Eyre District Court on the day that Priscilla Gustafsson and her children were murdered in Townsend. Despite having no facts or further information, when he heard the news, his immediate reaction was to say, "I wonder what Danny LaPlante is up to lately." Such was his near certainty that an individual as evil as Daniel could have been responsible for this heinous crime. He thought maybe he'd only been practicing at the Bowen house. You know, maybe he'd just been testing his skills. Now, obviously there was a bit more to it than just suspicions. Daniel had just been released from a juvenile facility, and he was living only a half a mile away from the crime scene. So pretty early on, he was put on a list of prime suspects. But Lane's hunch would prove to be correct, and it didn't take long to implicate Daniel in the murder with forensic evidence. They found the two .22 caliber bullet casings. They found an open can of beer, and they found the ligatures made from the pantyhose used to tie Priscilla to the bed. And they also found the semen stains from her rape. In the LaPlante house, the police also found a TV cable box and a cordless phone that Daniel had stolen from the Gustafsons with his fingerprints on them. They also found Daniel's blue and white shirt and gloves that he wore when he drowned the children, dumped in the woods behind the Gustafson house. They were still wet. Then using tracking dogs, who were actually able to get a scent from the shirt, the police were led through the woods right to the LaPlante house. Two state troopers interviewed Daniel that afternoon at the Townsend Public Library. Daniel told them that he had spent the previous day home alone watching television. When they asked what he was wearing the previous day, he claimed that he was wearing grey sweatpants, a football shirt, and a pair of Converse sneakers. A warrant was issued for Daniel LaPlante for the triple murder of Priscilla Gustafson and her two young children, but by then he had already fled. On the 3rd of December 1987, a command centre for the search for Daniel was based in Townsend. Lieutenant Lane, who was at the search, reasoned that Daniel would have probably left Townsend altogether and headed for a place that he was familiar with. Lane organised and led a search for Daniel in Pepperell, where the Bowens lived, because he had spent so much time there stalking them. The officers were heavily armed and wearing bulletproof vests as they searched through the woods and homes of Townsend and Pepperell. Obviously, this was an active manhunt, so the media were desperate for developments, but this proved to be a big obstacle for law enforcement. Members of media were just crowding the streets. People were out, hanging around. The search was chaotic. But despite this, sightings of Daniel began almost immediately. It helped that Lieutenant Lane was also able to distribute all those photos that he had taken of Daniel when he took him in for booking the previous year. Residents were calling in to say that they had seen a suspicious man in the area, and so state police and other law enforcement personnel joined in the search of Northwest Pepperell. While Lieutenant Lane and his partner, Officer Ken Beers, were maintaining the perimeter around a wooded area where they believed Daniel was hiding, they pulled into the driveway of 124 Jewett Street. A woman named Lynn McGovern, who lived at this house, had just arrived at her home 10 minutes before. She pulled into her driveway and went into the garage, but she reversed and sat in the driveway almost immediately, feeling extremely uncomfortable. The neighborhood was full of police. She knew who they were searching for, but something inside her told her not to go into her house at that moment. So 10 minutes went by where she sat in the car, and when she saw Lane and Beers in the cruiser, she kind of ran out of the car and she told them that she was feeling very apprehensive, and she asked if they would mind entering the house with her, just to help her feel less scared. Now, even though Lieutenant Lane thought to himself, crap, by helping this lady, I could be negatively affecting the containment of the perimeter, he decided that he wouldn't refuse her request. He thought he would just help her into the house to calm her fears, and he would do a quick search, and then he would be able to return to the containment mission. He had no idea that by agreeing with Lynn's simple request, he would literally save her life. Because what no one knew at that exact moment, Daniel LaPlante was hiding in the upstairs bedroom of Lynn McGovern's house and was actually watching their every move from the window. He was waiting in the bedroom, armed with a revolver, a shotgun, and a high-powered rifle. So Officer Beers waited outside in the cruiser, and Lieutenant Lane walked into the home with Lynn McGovern. Things happened very quickly once he entered the house. There was a loud noise upstairs, so Lane drew his weapon and started climbing the stairs. At the top of the landing, he found a 16-gauge shotgun lying flat on the floor. When he announced what he found, Lynn began screaming loudly. Lane came back downstairs to call for help. Daniel had fled the house, jumping from the second floor window onto the garage roof and then running into the woods before the house could be fully surrounded. Lieutenant Lane believed that Daniel had been waiting on the landing for him with the shotgun. But when he realized Lane's partner was outside, he abandoned his plan to kill Lane as he came up the stairs, and instead he chose to flee. The McGoverns found that they were missing an ammunition belt and 16-gauge shotgun ammo. Lieutenant Lane followed Daniel's flight path, and he quickly found the ammo belt rolled up and lying on the ground, containing 15 rounds of 16-gauge ammunition. Clearly after he had left the shotgun on the landing, Daniel no longer needed the useless ammo belt, and he chose to carry on with only the handgun instead. Just as he had done before, Daniel was able to change his plans on the fly as circumstances around him changed. Later in the day, there was a lot of media presence in the western part of town. It was getting dark, and Lieutenant Lane got several reports of a suspicious person around the area close to Town Hall to the east. Lane was checking the area when he heard the screaming of a woman coming from a house on Elm Street. It was very loud and it was very close by. He heard the screaming coming from the home of Edward Gilogley on Elm Street. Lane called out to him, "Ed, is he in there?" Mr. Gilogley shouted, "No, but get in here quick." There was a woman inside the house. Her name was Pam Michaela, and she was the one screaming. She told Lane that she had returned home to 17 Elm Street and found a man inside with a gun. She knew immediately it was Daniel LaPlante. Daniel told Pamela that she was going to drive him out of the area. Ludicrously, this big bad triple murderer explained to her that he only had a learner's permit. She then said the phone rang and Daniel told her to pick it up, which she did. It was a relative calling her, warning Pamela about the search for LaPlante. After the phone call, Daniel then forced her to get into her car and had her drive onto Elm Street. It was there that she noticed Ed Gilogley talking to someone in a vehicle. At the time, because of the darkness outside, she didn't realise that it was actually Lieutenant Lane in his marked cruiser. Either way, Pamela made a smart choice, probably a life-saving one. She jumped out of her car at the town hall, and she was quickly assisted by a passing driver into Ed Gilogley's house. Pamela immediately gave Lieutenant Lane crucial information about the terrifying encounter with LaPlante, which Lane immediately was able to broadcast to the other police officers. Now police had more information about the fugitive. They also knew the vehicle he was in and the direction he was travelling. But Daniel was driving in a bright orange van with a pop top and a sign for sale on the side. It was totally identifiable. So it didn't take long for him to be spotted driving the getaway vehicle in Ayr, Massachusetts by a Registry of Motor Vehicles inspector named Charlie Nelson. Daniel abandoned his ridiculous looking getaway vehicle and ran away. Lieutenant Lane went to Ayr and he told the officers there that Daniel could literally hide absolutely anywhere. This kid could disappear. He could crawl, squat, crouch into any space. They couldn't afford to overlook a single crack or corner. officers Scott Camo and Paul Baratta found Daniel LaPlante hiding in a large trash dumpster behind a building not long after this. Officer Baratta said, "I saw him when he stuck his head out of the dumpster. By then, there was nowhere to go." A Massachusetts State trooper yelled out, "Do we have a positive ID on this guy?" Officer Besenson, remember, he was the one who had found Daniel hiding in the Bowen house. He was actually also in Ayr looking for Daniel again at the time. And he went to the location where they found Daniel and he told the trooper, "I locked him up a year ago. It's him." The state trooper responded with a thumbs up and a smile. I bet they were all smiling that night. After his arrest, Daniel was transported to the Massachusetts State Police Barracks on Elm Street in Concord. When he was forced to strip, Daniel finally admitted that he had a gun which he had stolen from Lynn McGovern's house, hidden in the crotch of his underwear. Throughout all of this, his demeanour was cold, calm, and his mind was constantly calculating. Now, Frank Bowen didn't feel much relief when Daniel was captured. Even though the Bowens had abandoned their old home on Lawrence Street, after hearing about the murder of the Gustafsons, he still got his daughters and immediately went into seclusion. He feared that Daniel would get out again, he would escape or he would find some way out, and he would target his family again. When Frank was interviewed, he said, "If LaPlante does not get convicted and gets out again, I will personally kill him." Even though the Bowens were happy as hell about Daniel being captured at last, they still put the house in Pepperell up for sale out of fear. Frank even stopped sending his daughters to school for a while, but it wasn't without a huge cost. The family had to move town, costing $30,000, and Frank said, "Now I'm financially broke and emotionally disturbed and trying to put my life together again." The Bowens were left with awful trauma after the months of torment, all the taunting, all the threats. And the scary part is, if Officer Besenson hadn't found Daniel in his very well-concealed hiding place, he very easily might have killed the Bowens too. Daniel's brother Stephen found the murder weapon used to kill the Gustafsons in the glove box of their parents' car on April 7th, 1988. The trial began on October 1988, and more crucial evidence was revealed. The bullet casings found in the home matched this gun. There were fibers from Daniel's t-shirt and socks found at the crime scene, as well as shoe prints in the flower bed outside the Gustafson's home, which matched a pair of Converse that he owned. When Andrew Gustafson was asked during the trial by Assistant District Attorney Tom Riley why he hadn't searched for his children after finding his wife dead, the courtroom was so quiet you could hear a pin drop. Andrew Gustafson began to cry, and he told the jury that he was afraid that he would find his children dead too. Judge Robert Barton said in all his years as a judge, he's never forgotten that moment. He also said of Daniel LaPlante, if Massachusetts had the death penalty, he would personally like to pull the switch. Daniel was ordered to undergo a psychiatric examination, and it determined that he was sane at the time of the murders. Even though he pleaded not guilty, Daniel showed no remorse, and he even smiled throughout the trial. In the end, Daniel LaPlante was convicted of 3 counts of murder for the killing of Priscilla, Abigail, and William Gustafson. He was sentenced to 3 consecutive life terms without the chance of parole. Andrew Gustafson was able to move back into his family home eventually. He wanted to reclaim the house and make it a source of strength where he could keep the memories of his family alive. He said, the love that occurred there was much stronger than the death that occurred there. A year later, he married a widow named Carol, and they went on to have 2 daughters together. Andrew said he often had dreams of Priscilla and his 2 children. He enjoyed 25 years of married life with Carol before he died from cancer on May 22nd in 2014, and he was laid to rest with his first wife and children. However, on March 22nd, 2017, There was a resentencing hearing for Daniel LaPlante held at Middlesex Superior Court in Massachusetts. LaPlante was trying to get a reduction in his sentence, citing previous court's rulings that suggested juveniles convicted of murder should be given a meaningful opportunity to re-engage with society. Since his conviction, there had also been a new law passed allowing, quote, juveniles convicted of murder with extreme cruelty and atrocity to ask for parole after they have been behind bars for a minimum of 30 years. Daniel, then aged 47, apologized to the Gustafson family for the first time at this hearing. He stated, I do not have the words to fully express my profound sorrow, but I am truly sorry for the harm that I have caused. From the very essence of who I am, from the depths of my soul, I am sorry. But Daniels still couldn't show any emotion, though. It was obvious that he had manufactured this apology with selfish motivations in mind. And thankfully, the judge affirmed LaPlante's sentence of 3 consecutive life terms of imprisonment, with the possibility of parole after 45 years, after a forensic psychiatrist evaluated Daniel and found that he was still not remorseful for his crimes. It's very clear that Daniel LaPlante has no sympathy, no empathy, no remorse. He had no reason to kill the Gustafsons, especially not the children, who probably couldn't have even identified him. It didn't faze him what he did. He ruined so many lives. Tina and Karen Bowen are still suffering from their ordeal back in 1986. Their father Frank was never able to recover from the guilt and stress of it all, and he died at age 50, leaving them parentless. Daniel will be eligible for parole in 2032, when he will be aged 62. The Massachusetts court system failed society when they first paroled Daniel LaPlante after his torture and kidnapping of the Bowen family. He played the abused youth card in his defense, alleging that his unformed brain and years of sexual abuse drove his actions. Even though he might not be the greasy, pimply-faced boy he was anymore, I have no doubt that he's spent the past 35 years in prison going over every detail in his crimes that got him caught. He is clever enough that if he was ever released, he would never make those same mistakes again. He's a true psychopath, and I definitely hope he dies in prison. So, let me know what you guys think of the case, if you even believe how crazy the details are. And I'll see you guys in the next episode. Bye!